Welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast that's really worried about having Richard E. Grant living in our plumbing. I'm Nathan.
I'm Brendan.
I'm James.
I'm Peter.
Well, it's the first episode of a new season, sort of, and so the Doctor's back on Earth meeting his new companion for the first time, sort of. It's 2013, we're living in a Wi-Fi soup, and Habbo Hotel is the biggest thing on the internet. And it turns out that the ringing in our ears is the bells of St. John.
As I like to call it, what Claudia Bing did next.
Yeah, we finally have Celia Imrie, Star Wars' Celia Imrie, actually.
Celia Imrie of Bing, Bing, Bing and Bing.
So she does actually fly one of those Naboo spaceships in The Phantom Menace. Mm-hmm. Her son Angus is Zero on Star Trek Prodigy. So this is a pretty serious kind of...
Was her grandmother in The Tomorrow People?
Yeah. Every scene, she was the Clara of The Tomorrow People.
She was Tyso.
Such a versatile actress. Yeah, I feel like Celia Imrie's casting in this is Moffat going, all right, yes, I should have given Olivia Colman more to do. Here, have Celia Imrie being just fabulous and evil and delicious.
So she is kind of the Miss Foster of this episode, because I think everyone more or less says that this is like an RTD season opener.
Yeah, totally. Like, it's a modern day story. We get to see what Clara's life is like through a montage at the beginning.
Yeah.
Before, you know, the Doctor gets involved. We've got major London landmarks.
Yeah.
Being a front for
I was
alien
thinking
invasion.
About that. Is it actually the first time we've visited modern day recognizable central London since Aliens of London, World War III?
Central London.
Yeah. Recognizable St. Paul's Cathedral, Shard.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, you know, I remember at the time thinking that I missed London during the early Moffat era, around about this time, that there was something. There was something sort of positive and optimistic and exciting about having Doctor Who and having Doctor Who in recognisable London rather than somewhere cheaper or somewhere kind of less interesting.
That's right, the Sidemen marching down the steps of, you know, Chichester Cathedral. Would it quite work, right?
Yes, of course, this is pre-Brexit, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I think that's the thing, James, because when Doctor Who first came back, it was all that kind of New Labour, kind of British brand and all of that. Whereas, you know, after 2010, it had all kind of soured slightly. So we just didn't visit London as much.
Although this was produced around when London had the Olympics.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And there's been a lot of talk since the Brexit vote. It's like, you know, in 2012, all eyes were on the UK and we were the shining beacon of culture and sport and multiculturalism. And then 4 years later, this happens.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of attitude and that sort of pride is sort of typified by the scene where they land on the South Bank and the Doctor pulls out his fez and he's taken by it. Because you see buskers on the South Bank all the time in London. But it's a confident thing of showing off Doctor Who in its 50th anniversary year, showing off, you know, this is a British institution and this is a proudly British institution. And when I was rewatching this episode, I remembered that scene coming up and I'm like, I want to see if this is smug, if this is too much. And I'm like, no, I think this is pitched just right. This is pride in the series.
Yeah.
Not, this isn't a bragging moment, but this is a we're here and this show is fabulous moment.
I was kind of taken back to Rose by that scene on the South Bank, but I also think there's something to be said for going back as far as things like the invasion and the war machines.
And also, given the great intelligence connection, the Web of Fear, obviously you're going to be in central London.
Yeah. The Web of Fear had been just rediscovered in the previous few months or something?
I don't think we knew then officially.
Yeah, the BBC knew, but we didn't.
Yeah. So hence Moffat knew, which is why we're doing this sort of thing. I mean, the Shard, and I remember seeing the Shard for the first time and actually not really believing it. And like, I can't remember when I had previously been to London, but it was a few years before the Shard existed. And so there's the Shard in this. And then, you know, 5 years later, I think is the most recent time I've been in London, thanks to various circumstances beyond our control. And just seeing the Shard down the end of the street, it's so strange, isn't it? Our CBD.
Did you stop and point at it and go, Shard?
Well, it's our CBD in Sydney is just full of skyscrapers like any kind of new world city. And London is surprisingly different.
Is increasingly so.
Yeah. But
in a really upsetting way.
But also, it's a South Bank skyscraper and you don't get them.
Right.
There's very few skyscrapers south of the river.
I think it's a great inclusion because it is like the way that Russell included the Gherkin in Christmas Invasion.
And that clock tower in Aliens of London.
Yeah. With a backwards clock face on.
Whatever it's called.
Oh, and, you know, like putting UNIT under the Tower of London and having the Thames flood things house the Rachnos and all of that sort of stuff. We talked in our Rise of the Sidemen episode about having all of the population of London walk into Battersea Power Station to be sawn up. You know, like all of that stuff was great. I really, really missed it because I think at the time I said, this is Russell enchanting London, you know, making London a place where lots of Doctor Who stories have happened. Mm. And so it's nice to see Moffat borrowing that as well.
Yeah. It's the double-edged sword.
Much like the Shard.
You know, you see Moffat kind of go, okay, I'm going to show you what regional England looks like with Ledworth and what have you.
Yeah.
Later, Chris Chibnall will say, well, what about Sheffield?
Yeah.
And Moffat, of course, will say, well, what about Bristol? And, you know, it's kind of like, yes, all these places, they're centres of culture and learning and what have you. But a lot of international audiences look at it and go, where's London?
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's a great shame. I haven't been to Sheffield, but I have been to Bristol, and Bristol's bloody wonderful.
And you've never been to me. So.
That was the previous season.
Ledworth isn't a real place, and it is a village from a storybook. I mean, it is, you know, Series 5 moves Doctor Who out of the real world.
Yeah, but London of Doctor Who is not...
No.
It is a romanticised London because it's based around all these landmarks as well. It's just trying to do that in other places. An international audience doesn't recognise it as much as London.
Yeah.
It's like Torchwood making Cardiff happen.
Yeah.
It's why rom-coms are set in New York and not in, I don't know, Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And that...
No, Antonio Banderas, Tom Hanks, laugh a minute.
I think that shot of Matt Smith riding the motorcycle up the side of the Shard is absolutely superb. And, you know, I was actually expecting it to be a little bit crummy just from my memory of it, but I think it just falls on the right side of what we're able to do.
There was a feeling I had coming back to this season that it was a season of excess. You know, the show's on a high, it's building up to the 50th anniversary. I had a feeling, oh, you know, there's going to be moments where they go too far and there should have been someone tapping Stephen on the shoulder and saying, no, rein it in. But I think that scene of going up the Shard is a great example of the fact that he was still in control because, now, first of all, it would have been very difficult to financially afford the shot of the Doctor breaking through the glass on the motorcycle.
Yeah.
But I think the bigger reason they don't do it is it would have been irresponsible to show it. You know, because that is an imitable stunt that a child could do attempt to do on their bike. And it's like, no, we're going to do it with sound effects and we're going to show that it's dangerous because there's going to be a wind whipping through and whatnot. It's like, okay, no, that is actually some very subtle thought going into that.
But as a sitcom writer, Moffat must know the importance of the off-screen comedy smashing noise.
Yes, that's
you
true.
Know, like
well.
That
yeah.
is, and it is properly
like
funny.
Spearhead from yeah. space.
But and, you know, then Miss Kislet comes into the office and says, "Sorry about the draft." And stuff like that.
Yeah, it's great, and I think that in Series 7, the technology has caught up with the HD as well. You've had a couple of ropey effects in the previous seasons through no fault of their own, but they're kind of, they're writing the ship now.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is slightly ropey and no one watching
Doctor
it.
Doctor Who ropey.
Yeah. No one watching it is going to think that Matt Smith is really riding a motorcycle vertically up the side of the Shard. Probably.
Oh, you've destroyed my illusions.
They actually laid the Shard down flat and tilted the camera.
Yeah,
they
okay.
came in when they were constructing it before it was hoisted up.
Yeah. Okay, fair enough.
Burt Ward was actually hanging behind him in the first take. Sammy Davis Jr.
I never saw any of this on Confidential.
Well, you see, it's only on the original broadcast version, and then they cut all that out for DVD, and they don't put in enough Danny Hargreaves.
Yeah. Yep.
It's Sorry. No such thing as enough Danny Hargreaves.
Quiet. Wait, where was I?
This is also obviously as an RTD season opener, our chance to meet a new companion. So how do we feel about how Clara ends up coming across in this first episode?
I don't hate Clara in this first episode, and at some undetermined point in the future, I do stop liking her, but not here.
Yeah.
Well, as Brendan puts it, which Clara?
Yeah.
All of them.
Yeah.
Like, there are so many Claras.
Yeah. Like, I've always been of the opinion that Clara is written as a different character in each of her three series, and always brilliantly played by Jenna. But I adore this one. She is funny. She's capable of, you know, being a bit caustic without being mean.
Yeah.
There's that beautiful bit, which is I think is only a second or third line, where she's sort of gently pushing Angie. Oh, have you done this? Have you done that? And Angie says, "You're not my mum." And Clara says, "And I'm not trying to be."
Yeah.
Mm. And it's a really sweet and sensitive moment that tells you what's happened before she has to explain it to the doctor at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think Jenna makes a great impression this episode and somehow, you know, manages to do all those likable things without becoming unreal.
There's a lightness of touch to the characterization, which maybe gets lost in later seasons with different versions of the character.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that she is the absolutely generic companion in this episode and this season. And I don't mean that as a bad thing. I think she's kind of Sarah Jane Smith redux in the fact that she comes in, she does all the perfect companion things. She's played really well. She doesn't have a whole lot of character. And that's actually a classic series companion. It's powered by the performance.
Yeah. I think that that's it. I'm not super convinced that we have lots of different Claras because I do think that Jenna is holding it all together with her performance. And, you know, how many different Nisses do we have and Tegans and so on, you know, because we're not writing to a sort of template. Moffat wants his companions to be smarter than the Doctor on the whole. And here we have Clara calling him "you clever boy," which she's done in her previous two appearances, which kind of, it's not patronizing, but it is her putting herself in a sort of situation where she can assess him and where she calls him a boy. And the bit at the end where she says, "Actually, no, I'm not running off with you. Come back at 7 tomorrow." And we'll see how that plays out in the next episode. So Moffat wants both Amy and Clara to be in charge of the Doctor in some sort of way, or to be better at some things than the Doctor.
It's how he evens up the traditional Doctor-companion imbalance.
Yeah. We're stuck in a situation where the lead is male and then the secondary character is female. And in fact, he tends to de-emphasize the Doctor, I think, a bit in this story.
There's even a line in this story about, "She's very intelligent, but not very good with computers."
Yeah.
Like, it's clearly stated this is an intelligent, clever person.
I have to say, I mean, I do enjoy this episode very much, but that's one of my problems with it, and possibly one of my problems with Clara in this episode, that this episode is all about sort of middle-class technophobia. You know, there's an internet and people can watch you. Yeah. They can track you down on social media and things like that. But
taking
the
pictures of their webcam.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think that does happen. Yeah. But
see, QED.
But the fact, I mean, that's quite funny. I think Moffat's poking fun at himself as well slightly with that. But the fact that he projects that onto Clara and initially makes her a bit of a dunce with technical things is a bit kind of ho-hum.
I actually do know people. So Clara's what, 24 at this point?
Yeah.
I know people who are kind of bad at technology, even though they're sort of substantially younger than me. It isn't unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, like, usually in these kind of things, it'll be the younger character who gets the technology and the older character who's left floundering going, huh, what? I actually see that as a nice subversion. And I think what makes it work is Clara treats the computer like it's the stupid thing, you know, and there is a line in the draft script where when she's struggling it, she says, what even are you? A television you can type on. Who needs that?
It is another one of these things where Moffat is absolutely a middle-aged guy who doesn't know how the internet works at all.
Well, he introduced the internet in Press Gang.
He did too.
Has anyone checked with Chris Bidmead to see if he lapped this up?
It is very funny.
Yeah. I've mentioned before that with Asylum of the Daleks, I was fortunate enough to go see that at the BFI.
Ooh.
And there was a chat afterwards with Matt, Karen and Arthur, and it came up that Matt Smith hates Twitter. And that's where the line about you knew nothing about computers 2 hours ago and you just made a joke about Twitter. Clara's like, it's people screaming into the void.
There's such vehemence in the way he pronounces the word Twitter.
Yeah. I think someone asked Karen about her social media. I think she had quite an active Instagram at the time. And Karen's like, oh, do you guys have Instagram? And Arthur's like, oh, I've got an Instagram, but I don't really use it. And Matt's like, no. No, I've got Facebook. I might get Instagram one day. I'm not getting on Twitter.
He's a man after my own heart.
Did Moffat get hounded off Twitter? Was that
That was another thing.
Which
is probably another place that like comes from people screaming into the
is
void.
Disgusting sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, not you, gentle listener.
You're very attractive.
You're very special to us.
Speaking of people screaming into the void, that teaser, which is really great, all I can see as it pulls out is that next to the central guy who's been talking throughout the teaser on his left is Scotty Hancock, my friend Scott. So I was thinking, because I think he was the production secretary at the time, and so that's why he's making a Brain of Morbius style cameo. Yeah. But I was thinking I must Zoom with Scott one of these days so I can personalize the experience.
Just edit it into the episode.
It is one of the things that makes this not a pure RTD season opener is that the actual threat is pure Moffat, isn't it? It's, you know, don't click on the thing. There's this thing that inhabits something that is around you every day. There's a thing about it that causes you to have a catchphrase when it attacks you.
Whatever you do, don't click.
Yeah.
Good advice.
But it is that, you know, I don't know where I am. And it is a sort of weird conceptual thing, like some things living in the Wi-Fi. Mm. It's not, you know, rhino policeman or anything like that.
The thing is, when I watched it first back in 2013, I thought, oh, this is a bit silly. And Moffat doesn't really understand what Wi-Fi is. You
know, yeah.
It's not living in the Wi-Fi, actually. It's living in the internet. I'm sitting here like this. And, you know, I misunderstood what the spoonheads were. I'm like, oh, so what, Clara's router has suddenly grown legs and she's like, no, it is explained in the story.
I'm not going there, James.
I know,
How do English people? How do English
she
people
be amused?
How do English people manage to call it a router with a straight face? That seems crazy.
See, that's the thing I love about Australian English. We call a root a root, and a router a router.
Yeah.
To differentiate
the two things. It's very strange.
Yeah, yeah.
And the combination of the two is a router.
Yeah, on death to the Dalek style root problem.
And I think we're getting the beginning of his sort of weird doing CGI manipulations with heads on the aliens as well. So you've got the sort of weird spoon heads turning around. Later on, we'll have people who can sort of zip their heads diagonally and stuff like that. I mean, all of this is very Moffat.
It is. I have to say, even though, again, I'm at pains to say I do enjoy this episode, it feels slightly warmed over, the concepts in this. I think it all feels like a bit Silence in the Library.
Yeah.
The spoon heads are a bit node-like.
Yeah.
And that I don't know where I am sort of took me back there as well.
Yeah.
It all feels a little bit like he didn't have a very strong idea for the episode.
No. It's super thin, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that's also part of the RTD-ness of it.
Yeah.
In that RTD's season openers are deliberately thin.
Especially Partners in Crime.
Especially Partners in Crime. Especially Smith and Jones. Like, Smith and Jones ends 10 minutes before the ending so you can have the character moments. But
they're there to serve a purpose, which is to be accessible and to get someone involved who doesn't necessarily want to get bogged down with all of the back plot.
Yeah.
There's an accessibility about these season openers, which maybe goes missing in later seasons. And I think that's the right choice.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd agree.
The other thing, though, I mean, the RTD openers all have reasonably thin plots, but one thing that they do have that this doesn't have is kind of interesting characters. There's a guy, is he called Marla, the guy with glasses?
And
the other guy who's called Alexei. So there are two people who are in the office with Miss Kislet. But Miss Kislet's really the only person there, and we don't really get to meet anyone else at all. And when you think about, say, Partners in Crime, is it Stacy that Donna goes to visit?
Yeah, there's Stacy, there's Penny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You've got Sylvia and
the girls.
Yeah, 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 being reintroduced. Like, there's lots of fun people, and it's not what Moffat does here at all. There's nearly no one at all. We get to see Angie and Artie, and I think their father, Mr. Maitland, who's first name I don't even know. They've got very, very minor roles.
Does he just have a first name?
I don't know. Hmm. Just a couple of lines each, you know.
Captain. He's from the Sensorite. That's actually part of my issue with this episode, is that it's not quite as fun as you anticipate it will be. And so we've got Celia Imrie of Bing, Bing, Bing and Bing. And she's fantastic, but I think the character's a bit thin. And so she's not quite as fantastic as I thought she might be.
Yeah.
Mm. This feels a lot like season 24 to me, which you all know out there, dear listeners, I love season 24. And when you say, you know, Clara being a sort of generic companion and being a Sarah Jane, I actually see her a lot like Mel.
Absolutely.
She's slightly sarky, but she's there to have fun, you know, and she's totally happy to say to the Doctor, you're being stupid now, you know, you're being stupid and waving your fez around and whatnot. But yeah, in terms of the supporting characters, Marla and Alexei are not terribly interesting. There's a line that I'm very glad Moffat cut out, which during the bit where she's manipulating Marla to make him more compliant.
Yeah.
He basically wanders off and she just muses to herself, who knew he was gay when he came in?
Yeah.
And now she's convinced him he has a wife and whatnot. And I think Moffat's idea was she can change anything about you.
Yeah.
But there's no record I could find of why that line was removed, but I think it was probably removed because he went, actually, no, hold on.
That's terrible.
That's kind of terrible. And there's something he'll do next week as well, which I will cover at the time, which again was cut out of the script. And I don't know from reading it if it was Moffat or Neil Cross, but someone kind of went, oh, actually, no, I can see what you're going for there, but
let's not.
Yeah. It does give Celia a bit of a chance to shine. And it's kind of like a lot of what you see Celia in, she has, of course, played villains in the past, but quite often, even when she's Claudia Bing, you know, she's only a villain in so much as she's the antagonist to Eddie, but it's not like Eddie's a nice person. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Claudia Bing's probably altogether more professional.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Celia is most famous for Acorn Antiques, probably, yeah. But has done sort of period dramas since then and what have you, and is usually sort of a kindly matron or aunt sort of figure. So to have her here unrelentingly sinister while still being Celia Imrie, you know, it's really powerful. And she has that wonderful line of, no one loves cattle more than Burger King.
That's so good, isn't it?
And it's amazing that they could get away with
pointing
at a brand like that.
That's it. Other hamburger places are also available.
Yes.
Can we just talk briefly about how her character ends, that final scene?
It's heartbreaking.
Well, it's the sort of thing that isn't horrible if you're a kid watching it, right? But it's conceptually really terrifying if you're an adult.
It's the same thing as in The Snowman, isn't it, with the corrupting influence of the great intelligence children.
Yeah, that's right. It's also Imrie's performance, I think, in that scene when she's being the little girl, because she's so good. And that could come off ridiculous. That could easily have flopped, that scene, I think. But I don't think it does. And it is this sort of terrifying thing where a 9-year-old girl suddenly wakes up and her parents are dead and she's an old woman, you know.
Yeah.
What's also quite deep about that scene is you get everyone else in the office first and they're just kind of like, oh, hold on, I came in to fix the loo.
Yeah, that was Marla, wasn't it?
I came in to fix the loo. Where am I? It's like, oh, are you soldiers? Can you help me? And it's kind of like, okay, these people have maybe lost a couple of months.
Yeah.
The person responsible for it has lost more.
Yeah.
And so there's a sense of sacrifice in what she's done, but also a sense of justice, and it's kind of horrible and kind of uncomfortable in that way that Doctor Who does, where it's like sometimes a villain will get a comeuppance and you go, actually, was that what we should have done? Was that what should have happened to Solomon in Dinosaurs on a Spaceship?
Yes.
Yes.
When Terence Dix writes the novelization of The Sunmakers, he has the workers regret throwing the Gatherer off the roof. They're like, it went a little bit far.
That's not nearly as funny.
No, he's what a class traitor.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, he doesn't condemn, but he kind of goes, these people are human.
Yeah.
And that guy is human even if he's a horrible monster, you know what I mean? Just in a couple of lines, it's showing moral complexity as well as character, as well as giving Celia, as you say, a great moment, which she pictures perfectly. It would have been so easy to overdo.
Yeah.
Especially seeing as so far, you know, her character has been quite arch.
Yeah.
But as an actress, she just really strips it down to a very believable and, as you say, very, very scary level, which to a kid would understand what happened, but a kid hasn't grown into an adult, so doesn't know what's been lost, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was going to kill Alexei after he came back from his holiday.
Oh, yeah.
What's it? My conscience says that we should probably kill him.
I also like the fact that at the end, even though I have slight misgivings about the episode before that, I really like that it's got one of those Moffat twists, which you don't see coming, where the Doctor who rides up the side of the shark turns out to be a spoonhead and he's got the helmet on, so you don't know. It's vintage Moffat.
Yeah.
And something I also love about it, because I'd actually forgotten that
watching
this time, something I love about it as well is when he's riding up there, I'm like, Clara is all alone and dying.
Yeah.
You know, and then of course, no, she's not. You know, he won't leave her alone. And then when he knows she's safe, he kind of just rubs her head a bit and walks off. And my reading of that is him going, I've saved her this time.
Yeah.
And she's not in danger now and I can go away. And then obviously a day or so later, he's like, well, if she's safe now, she, you know, we can be friends.
Yeah.
And Matt is one of the finest actors to ever play the Doctor, and he just picks out such nuance.
Great in every scene.
It's really nice, isn't it? It's interesting that one of the ways that the misdirect works is that that's the Doctor's hero moment for the episode, and it gets given to the Spoonhead disguised as the Doctor. Yeah. And even Murray is doing the kind of hero music as he rides up the skyscraper and everything. So it surprised me as well. I'd forgotten too.
And you get a proud bear holding a bag of chips getting to be Celia.
So great.
It's my dream. Also, good Lord.
He's really great, isn't he?
I really like one of the classic Moffat lines there. Your dad called mainly about the government. He's very cross at that is every phone call I have with my dad. It's great.
It's so funny, isn't it? And he's even – so he's reading the answering machine messages that have happened while Clara was asleep. And there's one from Angie as well. And he repeats this, you know, so just get off her back, will you? Like, he's really funny reading that stuff out. And it is classic Moffat sitcom stuff, isn't it?
There's another bit that I'm glad Moffat cut out there, which is, you know, Clara's unconscious, the Doctor puts her to bed and then sits outside because it's the gentlemanly thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, in the original script, Clara wakes up and she's like, whose nightdress is this? And the Doctor says, Mata Hari's. She gave it to me. She said it was her only one. I have no idea why. And I'm just like, yeah, but Moffat realizes the implication is that the Doctor has undressed Clara and put her in it. And he's kind of gone, maybe not.
In fact, that's adorable, that scene where he sort of parked himself out the front in his mobile phone and he's sitting in the chair in front of it and stuff, and they're chatting via the window. I think that is really, really terrific. And she kind of says, you know, you're guarding me, aren't you? And he says yes.
That's really cute.
Yeah, it's really good.
And he's invented the quadricycle.
Matt's delivery of that is so perfect.
So funny. Oh, my God. What an idiot. It's so brilliant.
And you have that bizarre little set piece afterwards, which doesn't quite fit but is quite fun, where they're suddenly in the cockpit of a plane, which he prevents from crashing. I was thinking, when was the last time the Doctor was in a cockpit of a plane? Time flight. This is better than time flight.
Yes, it is.
Again, I really like that. I think that's really terrific. We just have one scene in the plane, and I think it's nearly a hitchhiker's quote, isn't it? It's the, can you fly a plane? No, neither can I. All right, let's do it together.
Yeah,
is
exactly.
that it?
Yeah, when they take manual control of the Heart of Gold in Hitchhikers. Yeah, that's it. Zaphod, Ford and Trillian have that exchange.
Yeah, yeah.
And then from across the room, Arthur says, I can't fly it either. No one asked.
I guessed that.
Now, the thing is, as I was watching that plane scene this time, I'm like, I know now why I like this episode so much. This feels like the color series of the Avengers. Like, it's fast-paced, it's frenetic. You don't see them traveling from location to location a lot. And when they do, you know, it's exposition about what they're going to do. Like, when Steed and Emma are in the Bentley, it's like, oh, where are we going? We're going here. Why are we going there? They serve really good crumpets. Steed, okay, he's a dead scientist, you know.
Do you think that that's the dynamic that Moffat was going for with the Doctor and Clara in this season?
I think quite possibly, yes. And I think that feeds into the quasi-romantic element of that. And I think the quasi-romantic element works this time because it's not Amy who is engaged to Rory but throwing herself at the Doctor. It's a young woman who is confident in her own attraction and sexuality. Like, when she thinks the Doctor is coming on to her, her message is basically, don't assume, but also don't not assume.
Yeah.
It's kind of just down boy.
Yeah, and so there is a real sort of quirk between them. And then when she's sort of flirting with him but also being rude to him in the cafe, and he's just like, I do not have – what is – coffee, okay. And again, that's very Avengers as well, in that Steed would flirt with Mrs. Peel and she'd kind of rebuff him, and occasionally she'd flirt with him and he'd just look up like, what? I'm sorry, can we – Okay, no, you're hitting someone now. All right, fine.
It's really the whole dynamic is the reverse of the Tennant Doctor, is it? Where he was sexually confident and the companions yeah. were a bit taken aback.
Yeah.
Whereas now it's always the companions who are sexually confident. The Doctor's like,
I did have one more thing to mention.
Yeah.
Now, of course, as we mentioned earlier, the BBC were aware that the Web of Fear was coming back. But by this point, the problems had happened, which I'll get into. But if you look at Miss Kislet's badge, it's two circles.
Her what?
Her badge.
Oh. Oh, dear.
If you look at Miss Kislet's brooch, Peter, you've got a ring inside another ring. So, O-O.
Oh.
And Doctor Who story codes back in the classic series start at A through to Z, and then A-A through to Z-Z, and so on and so forth. And then there's three bars. And what episode of The Web of Fear is missing? Episode 3. And this would be such a great reference if O-O was not, in fact, the Ice Warrior.
Right.
And I'm totally misleading you.
So what is The Web of Fear?
Oh,
I thought you knew these.
NN.
Back in the day.
it's NN. No, hold on. O-O-P-P-Q-Q.
Oh, okay. Q-Q. What's NM? Enemy of the world.
And NN is the... hold on. No, PP is the enemy of the world.
Oh, my
please
God.
Enjoy this, listeners.
I'm cutting all of this.
Two Patricks. You
know this. Don't you know there, this?
There's someone out there screaming at us because one of them is wrong.
Screaming in joy and ecstasy that we are, in fact, discussing this. Is that Simon? And we haven't even talked about the cute title.
Yeah, yes. So all that weird thing in Cumbria in 1207 as well.
It's just another little set piece that he's thrown
it's
in.
Just so you can make that joke.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's another kind of Moffat thing that Russell would never do, which is that, you know, we build a whole place and characters and stuff and then kind of throw them away. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, I sort of like it.
Mm. And you do get that moment of, is it a demon? It's a woman. Genuflect.
Yeah.
But something I noticed this time around, which of course I couldn't have noticed because last time I hadn't seen Heaven Sent, is that the Doctor is sitting in the dark in a castle ruminating with a portrait of Clara he's painted.
Yeah.
Mm.
Because she's died.
I also think too maybe there are elements of the first episode of Series 9 as well where he hides himself in the past, doesn't he, to kind of...
I think Matt
grumpy.
Smith could have pulled off playing an electric guitar on a tank?
Yeah.
To be fair, I think Peter does pull it off. You see, yeah, Matt would have played it discordantly and suddenly gone, oh, yeah, I can't play guitar. What am I doing?
Well, it's like that
ukulele.
Line. The line where he says he came last in the Gravity Olympics. You know, I came last. I think it's just a chance for sort of more wacky sitcom dialogue, and I guess that's as good a reason as any to have it.
Mm. Absolutely. Mm. And also, I just adore the fact that the episode is named after a silly throwaway gag.
Yeah.
We won't get that again until The Timeless Children.
This is part of Series 7, and Series 7's kind of remit is to be a feature film every week. And I think that we would probably agree that this doesn't quite hit that mark. But what the idea seems to be is standalone episodes that are fairly straightforward.
Mm. I think this does hit the mark in the way of it feels like a British invasion film.
Yeah.
You know, by which I mean the British sort of heist films of the 70s, because you have all those London settings. And also this is an episode clearly in love with Doctor Who's past and with film and sci-fi films. Like, we get a Star Trek 4 reference of, I can't tell the future, I just work there.
You know,
Captain Kirk isn't from outer space, he just works there. We've got the Doctor and Clara on the motorcycle having a chat. that is clearly a crib to the telly movie.
Yeah.
We've got some poles in the background, which is, you know, a throwback to The Invasion. And that's the weird thing. I find this episode derivative, but in a popcorn movie kind of
way. Affectionate.
Yeah, it's not being derivative because it can't come up with its own ideas. It's being derivative because it's like, these ideas are really good and we're going to arrange them in a new way for you.
Being referential and reverential.
Yeah. Mm,
yes.
All you really needed was Miss Kislet, played by Michael Caine in a wig.
It's funny that it's an episode that works absolutely on the level of being a fun thing to watch and not really being designed for like a bunch of dorks to sit around a coffee table podcasting about.
So why are we doing this thing?
And yet somehow
we manage.
I mean, it is fun and it is colourful. You can't hold anything against it.
Yeah. Mm. That's all we have time for this week. We'll be back next week for the green screen extravaganza that is The Rings of Akkerton. In the meantime, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and you can keep up with us at Flight Through Entirety on Facebook, at FTE Podcast on Twitter, and on our website, flightthroughentirety.com, where you'll find links to our other podcasts, Bonfinger, Jodie into Terror, Maximum Power, and Untitled Star Trek Project. Until next time, remember that if you're over 50 and posting political commentary on Twitter from your iPad, our base stations will be around to harvest you directly. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
I'm the Little Spoon. Good night.
Ta-ta.
Good night.
That was Flight Through Entirety, starring Nathan Bottomley, Peter Griffiths, Brendan Jones and James Selwood. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. This episode, A Proud Bear Holding a Bag of Chips Getting to be Celia Imrie, was recorded on the 29th of May 2022 and released on the 4th of September. Of course, Stephen Moffat's hostility to the internet isn't just the result of middle-class technophobia. His upcoming autobiography details a horrifyingly awkward incident where he was contacted by an unsolicited Fenderline who asked if he could add him to his professional network on LinkedIn.
And cut it to there.
What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think...
I think we're going to struggle to speak for this long. Like, that's probably... a bit over 40 minutes.
I do have one more thing I could bring.
Yeah, go on, say something.
So the woman in the shop.
Ah, yeah. Mm.
So this is when we're introduced to the idea of the woman in the shop. And look, if you're watching the new series along with us and you haven't seen Forward From Here, I'm not going to mention how that plot resolves itself.
Yeah, but it's Missy.
Spoilers.
Linda Barron.
You've got to wonder, 9 years later, maybe they should have watched this episode in the next season.
Darth Vader is Anakin Skywalker, folks.
Yeah, yeah. That smelly old man who just turned up in Ithaca is Odysseus.
Originally, she actually played a larger role in the plot. The woman in the shop, in that the doctor was going to get two phone calls during the episode.
Ah.
And one of them was just basically, well, how's it going? Have you met Clara?
Right.
Click.
Right.
Oh, actually, that would have paid off quite nicely.
Yeah. And then when he comes back at the end of the episode, just before that, he was going to get a call saying, after everything you've been through, are you sure you can trust her enough to find out who she is? And so this voice on the phone was going to be goading him. Now it was dropped in the early stages of the script. It was originally conceived as something that could happen throughout the season.
Right, okay.
And that makes more sense of calling the episode The Bells of
Sunshine. Because it's introducing the phone.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I think it was dropped so as not to put the cart before the horse.
Yeah.
You know, I think at this stage we want to believe that maybe this is all a coincidence. Maybe there's nothing sinister about Clara.
yeah,
you know, kind of thing. And that would have told us, no, there is.
Because the other big coincidence, I mean, the thing that convinces Matt that it is Clara isn't just that she calls him on the phone, but that the Wi-Fi password spells out "Run, you clever boy, and remember." And
one,
I
two,
think that,
three.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, 1, 2, 3. Just don't do that at home.
Just in case you didn't get it.
Like, I think that's a thing that will just never be explained, and that's fine. But we have this tension. We'll talk more about it next week, I think, between Clara just being a companion and Clara being a mystery or a puzzle box.
Yeah.
And I think that if this half season has a theme, it's probably that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the impossible girl.
Yeah, yeah, mm. Yeah.
And, you know, that does lead us to that lovely scene of Clara explaining why she's still living in the house.
Yeah.
And the Doctor has a really interesting line where he says, "I wish I was more like that." And it's kind of like, okay, but just before you lost Amy and Rory, you were exactly like that. You stayed for a year to see if the cubes were safe.
Yeah.
You know, you actually didn't run off. And I think it's sort of, it's a moment of dramatic irony. It's not the Doctor being modest. The Doctor genuinely believes he couldn't do that and wouldn't do that, even though he has, you know. And it's fascinating to me because, you know, he's the man who never stays still. She's a woman who willingly got stuck.
Yeah.
And that's something that's going to come back towards the end of this season.
What do you think then? I've got 55 minutes. Is there anything anyone else wanted to add?
No, I made my joke at the beginning.
I'm spent.
You shot your wand.
No, that's all I'm doing. Like, I should have just been silent for the rest of the episode. Yes, you should.
When is Tara?
You will be after editing.
Well, I self-edited it. Nathan said the thing I was going to, so you didn't have to.
The Maitland's house is smoky as fuck. It's just full of smoke.
Is it?
Yeah, to give a kind of soft lighting effect, but it's just really like smoky.
Oh yeah, that sort of dust streaming.
Yeah. And I also like, you know, when Clara hacks into the network, it's kind of like a reverse of the EastEnders title theme because you're panning up and you get drum beats. It's doof, doof,
doof, doof. I love all of the kind of, it's like sort of JavaScript, a little bit of HTML, a little bit of just complete. You know, yeah, Pearl. Yeah. Like, it's all just nonsense. Sorry, that's a very sophisticated joke about Pearl.
Mackie.
This isn't for the episode, obviously, but as you know, I'm currently obsessed with a game called The Stanley Parable. Mm-hmm. And there's a great YouTube series called Boundary Break, where they hack a game take the camera to view details you can't usually view. And there's a bit in the Stanley Parable where there's this room full of screens and one of them is flashing an error message, but you're like 50 meters away, you can't read it. And he zooms into it and it's like, error, 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 can't find file, error, error, error. Is anyone even reading this? Do you have any idea what it's like to have to make up a screen of this error text knowing that no one will ever read it? And he's like, well, this game came out 10 years ago and I hope you're out there.
All right, I'm going to press stop. What do you think?
Yeah, because you've already done the outro.
Nathan, they always know when you press stop.
Ooh.